It was after midnight when he was finally dressed and standing at the window looking out at Notre Dame. The streets were still crowded.
"Why will you not stay?" she said, pouting prettily. "I want you to stay. Don't you want to please me?"
"I'm sorry," he said. "I have to go. I don't feel very well."
"I will make you feel better."
He shook his head. In truth, he really did not feel well. He was experiencing waves of dizziness, and his legs felt oddly weak. His hands were trembling as he gripped the balcony.
"I'm sorry," he said again. "I have to leave."
"All right, then I will drive you."
Her car, he knew, was parked on the other side of the Seine. It seemed far to walk, but he just nodded numbly.
"All right," he said.
She was in no rush. They strolled arm in arm like lovers along the embankment. They passed the houseboat restaurants tied up to the side, brightly lit, still busy with guests. Above them, on the other side of the river, rose Notre Dame, brilliantly lit. For a while, this slow walk, with her head on his shoulder, the soft words she spoke to him, made him feel better. But soon he stumbled, feeling a kind of clumsy weakness coursing through his body. His mouth was very dry. His jaw felt stiff. It was difficult to speak. She did not seem to notice. They had moved past the bright lights now, under one of the bridges, and he stumbled again. This time he fell on the stone embankment.
"My darling,"
she said, worried and solicitous, and helped him to his feet. He said,
I think...
"Darling, are you all right?"
She helped him to a bench away from the river.
"Here, just sit here for a moment. You will feel better in a moment."
But he did not feel better. He tried to protest, but he could not speak. In horror, he realized he could not even shake his head. Something was very wrong. His whole body was growing weak, swiftly and astonishingly weak, and he tried to push up from the bench, but he could not move his limbs. He could not move his head. He looked at her, sitting beside him.
"Jonathan? What is wrong? Do you need a doctor?"
"Yes, I need a doctor," he thought.
"Jonathan? This is not right."
His chest was heavy. He was having trouble breathing. He looked away, staring straight ahead. He thought in horror, "I am paralyzed."
"Jonathan?"
He tried to look at her, but now he could not even move his eyes. He could only look straight forward. His breathing was shallow.
"Jonathan?
I need a doctor."
"Jonathan, can you look at me? Can you? No? You cannot turn your head?"
Somehow, her voice did not sound concerned. She sounded detached, clinical. Perhaps his hearing was affected. There was a rushing sound in his ears. It was harder and harder to breathe.
"All right, Jonathan, let's get you away from here."
She ducked her head under his arm, and with surprising strength, got him to his feet. His body was loose and floppy, sagging around her. He could not control where he looked. He heard clicking of footsteps approaching and thought, "Thank God." He heard a man's voice say in French,
"Mademoiselle, do you need help?"
"Thank you, but no," she said. "Just too much to drink."
"Are you sure?"
"He does this all the time."
"Yes?"
"I can manage."
"Ah, then, I wish you bonne nuit."
"Bonne nuit,"
she said. She continued on her way, carrying him. The footsteps became fainter. Then she paused, turned to look in all directions. And now she was moving him toward the river.
"You are heavier than I thought,"
she said, in a conversational tone. He felt a deep and profound terror. He was completely paralyzed. He could do nothing. His own feet were scraping over the stone, toward the river.
"I am sorry," she said,
and she dropped him into the water. It was a short fall and a stunning sense of cold. He plunged beneath the surface, surrounded by bubbles and green, then black. He could not move, even in the water. He could not believe this was happening to him. He could not believe that he was dying this way. Then, slowly, he felt his body rise, green again, and then he broke the surface on his back, turning slowly. He could see the bridge in the black sky, and Marisa, standing on the embankment. She lit a cigarette and stared at him. She had one hand on her hip, one leg thrust forward, a model's pose. She exhaled, smoke rising in the night. Then he sank beneath the surface again, and he felt the cold, and the blackness closed in around him. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the light snapped on in the laboratoire ondulatoire of the French Marine Institute in Vichy. The control panel came to life. The wave machine began to generate waves that rolled down the tank, one after another, and crashed against the artificial shore. The control screens flashed three-dimensional images, scrolled columns of data. The data was transmitted to an unknown location somewhere in France. At 4 o'clock, the control panel went dark, and the lights went out, and the hard drives erased any record of what had been done. Pahang, Tuesday, May 11th, 11:55 a.m. The twisting jungle road lay in shadow beneath the canopy of the Malay rainforest. The paved road was very narrow, and the Land Cruiser careened around the corners, tires squealing. In the passenger seat, a bearded man of 40 glanced at his watch.
"How much farther?"
"Just a few minutes," the driver said, not slowing. "We're almost there." The driver was Chinese, but he spoke with a British accent. His name was Charles Ling, and he had flown over from Hong Kong to Kuala Lumpur the night before. He had met his passenger at the airport that morning, and they had been driving at breakneck speed ever since. The passenger had given Ling a card that read, "Alan Peterson, Seismic Services, Calgary." Ling didn't believe it. He knew perfectly well that there was a company in Alberta, ELS Engineering, that sold this equipment. It wasn't necessary to come all the way to Malaysia to see it. Not only that, but Ling had checked the passenger manifest on the incoming flight, and there was no Alan Peterson listed. So this guy had come in on a different name. Furthermore, he told Ling he was a field geologist doing independent consulting for energy companies in Canada, mostly evaluating potential oil sites. But Ling didn't believe that either. You could spot those petroleum engineers a mile off. This guy wasn't one. So Ling didn't know who the guy was. It didn't bother him. Mr. Peterson's credit was good. The rest was none of Ling's business. He had only one interest today, and that was to sell cavitation machines. And this looked like a big sale. Peterson was talking about 3 units, more than $1 million in total. He turned off the road abruptly onto a muddy rut. They bounced through the jungle beneath huge trees, and suddenly came out into sunlight and a large opening. There was a huge semicircular gash in the ground, exposing a cliff of gray earth, a green lake below.
"What's this?" Peterson said, wincing.
"It was an open-faced mine, abandoned now, Kalin."
"Which is?"
Ling thought. This is no geologist. He explained that kaolin was a mineral in clay.
It's used in paper and ceramics. A lot of industrial ceramics now. They make ceramic knives incredibly sharp. They'll make ceramic auto engines soon. But the quality here was too low. It was abandoned 4 years ago.
Peterson nodded. And where is the cavitator?
Ling pointed toward a large truck parked at the edge of the cliff.
There.
He drove toward it. Russians make it?
The vehicle and the carbon matrix frame are Russian-made. The electronics come from Taiwan. We assemble ourselves in Kuala Lumpur.
And is this your biggest model?
No, this is the intermediate. We don't have the largest one to show you.
They pulled alongside the truck. It was the size of a large earth mover. The cab of the Land Cruiser barely reached above the huge tires.
In the center, hanging above the ground, was a large rectangular cavitation generator, looking like an oversized diesel generator, a boxy mass of pipes and wires. The curved cavitation plate was slung underneath, a few feet above the ground. They climbed out of the car into sweltering heat.
Ling's eyeglasses clouded over. He wiped them on his shirt. Peterson walked around the truck. Can I get the unit without the truck?
Yes, we make transportable units, seagoing containers, but usually clients want them mounted on vehicles eventually.
I just want the units, Peterson said. Are you going to demonstrate?
Right away,
Ling said. He gestured to the operator, high up in the cab.
Perhaps we should step away.
Wait a minute, Peterson said, suddenly alarmed. I thought we were going to be alone. Who is that?
That's my brother, Ling said smoothly. He's very trustworthy.
Well,
let's step away, Ling said. We can see better from a distance.
The cavitation generator fired up, chugging loudly. Soon the noise blended with another sound, a deep humming that Ling always seemed to feel in his chest, in his bones. Peterson felt it too, because he moved back hastily.
These cavitation generators are hypersonic, Ling explained, producing a radially symmetric cavitation field that can be adjusted for focal point, rather like an optical lens, except we are using sound. In other words, we can focus the sound beam and control how deep the cavitation will occur.
He waved to the operator, who nodded. The cavitation plate came down until it was just above the ground. The sound changed, becoming deeper and much more quiet. The earth vibrated slightly where they were standing.
Jesus, Peterson said, stepping back.
Not to worry, Ling said. This is just low-grade reflection. The main energy vector is orthogonal, directed straight down.
About 40 feet below the truck, the walls of the canyon suddenly seemed to blur, to become indistinct. Small clouds of gray smoke obscured the surface for a moment, and then a whole section of cliff gave way and rumbled down into the lake below, like a gray avalanche. The whole area filled with smoke and dust. As it began to clear, Ling said,
"Now we will show how the beam is focused."
The rumbling began again, and this time the cliff blurred much farther down, 200 feet or more. Once again the gray sand gave way, this time sliding rather quietly into the lake.
"And it can focus laterally as well?" Peterson said.
Ling said they could. 100 yards north of the truck, the cliff was shaken free and again tumbled down.
We can aim it in any direction and any depth.
Any depth?
Our big unit will focus at 1,000 meters, although no client has any use for such depths.
No, no, Peterson said. We don't need anything like that. But we want beam power.
He wiped his hands on his trousers.
I've seen enough.
Really? We have quite a few other techniques to
I'm ready to go back. Behind his sunglasses, his eyes were unreadable.
Very well, Ling said. If you are sure...
I'm sure.